I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Sherry Hooper. She's Executive Director of the Food Depot. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about what the Food Depot is. I think we have you on every year or so to remind people about this very important institution right here in Santa Fe. What's it all about?
Well, the Food Depot is the food bank that serves northern New Mexico. And really, very simply, what a food bank does is work at bringing donations of food in. We get them from a national level as part of Feeding America, which is the National Food Bank Network. They work really hard to get donations in from large food companies, where this food has actually they've overproduced, for example, or it's been damaged, or there's misprints on the packaging. They can donate that into the food bank system. At the state level, we are part of the New Mexico Association of Food Banks, and that really brings us two sources. One is the Food Bank Association has a produce initiative, which gets bulk produce into the food banks and out to people in need. The other is we have a contract with the Human Services Department of the state to distribute USDA commodities foods. And then locally, we are out 6 days a week picking up donations at grocery stores, bakeries, restaurants, catering services, you name it, anyone that has food they've taken off their shelves. And the bulk of our food locally comes from grocery stores. So it's food that they've taken off their shelves because it's reached that stamped date. It's a sell-by date. For example, yogurt, we can distribute 20 days past that date. Milk, we can distribute 5 days past that date.
So right, we tend to eat it 5 days past that date.
Yes, we do. So if you have some sitting in your refrigerator, it's okay.
Right.
So those are the kinds of things we get locally. Lots of produce that may have a bruise on it, something like that. Still really good food. And we go through it. We destroy what we deem unsafe, and then we can distribute the rest. So that's kind of how we get our food locally. And then as a food bank, our customers or clients are nonprofit food programs, like emergency food pantries, soup kitchens, shelters, group homes, daycare centers, youth programs like the Boys and Girls Clubs, you name it. We have 120 programs we currently serve, and we're serving 9 counties in northern New Mexico.
9 counties. That's a very large reach that you've got.
It is large. We deliver food as far as Clayton and Raton, for example.
Wow.
We also go north to Taos, Cuesta. Yeah, it's large. It's about 26,000 square miles.
So let's talk about the problem of hunger in New Mexico. I mean, we're a poor state. We're a big state. We're largely a rural state. What does it actually look like?
Well, hunger in New Mexico, let me talk first about, there was a study done not too long ago called Missing Meals. And this was a study that was actually, it really gave us good information because everyone was always saying, what are the gaps? How many more meals should we be providing? And this is a study that looked at things like if people had their own income and how much of their food they could buy with their own income. It looked at government programs and what people were able to get with the government programs, like food stamps, for example. What people were able to get at a food pantry. And then it looked at what was missing. And for our 9 counties, about 16 million meals are missing in northern New Mexico.
Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah,
so in a state of, what, 2 million people?
Exactly. And for the whole state, if you look at all the counties put together, it's about 117 million meals missing for New Mexico. When the economy took such a dive about 3 years ago or so, it's been so long now, it's hard to remember when it actually did.
Yeah.
You know, we were already in trouble, quite honestly. New Mexico ranks very high in poverty and hunger consistently. And so we already had our work cut out for us. And then when the economy took a dive, it just added more people to the list of people to help.
And when we talk about really all the other problems in New Mexico, if you think about it, everything stems back to hunger. Children can't learn in school if they're hungry. People can't find a job or perform well in a job if they're hungry.
Absolutely. We know that if we're able to provide food to a family, it means that the adult is going to be more productive at work. It means that the child is going to be able to go to school. And we find that study after study shows us a hungry child is ill and absent from school more often. They're not able to concentrate. They have developmental delays. These are children who won't even socialize or make friends. They won't play. And we have a program called Food for Kids that we do in the elementary schools in Santa Fe. And it's a program where we hope what we're doing is getting food directly into the hands of the children. So they can take it home. And when they don't have their school, they have school lunch, school breakfast. A lot of kids weren't even eating from school lunch one day to school breakfast the next day.
Oh, my goodness.
So what this does is it sends food home with the kids in backpacks. It's food that kids can eat. They don't need an adult to help them prepare a meal. And then they can take that food. They'll have access to it in the evenings and on the weekends when they're away from school.
Is there a stigma associated with the do kids feel stigmatized by, oh, we're the ones that are so poor that we get the backpack?
You know, actually, we work very hard to see that that doesn't happen. The backpacks we provide look just like everybody else's backpacks. They're not marked in any way. The schools tell the kids they're participating in nutrition programs. And so we haven't ever had a report that a child was made fun of or anything like that for participating in that program.
How do they identify which kids are hungry?
Well, a lot of the teachers will help, and they know the situations at home for their kids. And so they can identify the kids that are coming to school hungry, and they know who they are. So we don't actually even see a list of the kids. The school reports to us the number of kids they need to help, and we take that number of backpacks to the school, and then we deliver food every 2 weeks to that school, and it's a 2-week supply so that they have that food and they can fill the backpacks every Friday for the kids.
When we talk about so you're getting food, for example, from big food companies that have mislabeled food, and there's other sources, as you mentioned, but what's the nutritional value of that food? I mean, are we talking about junk food, or what are we talking about? Canned food where all the nutrients are gone? Are we talking about really good stuff?
Well, that's a debate right now, certainly. And it's something that we look at every day. We have a nutrition committee to really evaluate the food that we bring into the food bank. At this point, we can't afford to turn food away because it doesn't have great nutritional value because we're feeding so many people.
It has calories.
It has calories. Yeah. And you look at that. You look at food that's calorie dense versus nutrient dense. We're working very hard to bring in more nutrient dense food. When we have a choice, when we purchase food, for example, we bring in food that our nutrition committee has identified as good nutritional food. The produce initiative that we do with the Food Bank Association brings in a lot of good produce into the food bank and we get it out to people in need. So we're really working to see that the nutritional value of the food we distribute is high. At this time, though, we just simply can't afford to turn food away if it doesn't have great nutritional value.
Right. I mean, we talked on this program a while back about a movie called Food Stamped, which was about a couple who were trying to live on food stamps and nourish themselves. And basically, if they wanted to eat healthy food, they didn't get enough calories. And if they wanted to get enough calories, they were eating junky food.
And that's exactly what working families face these days. And we're seeing food costs rise. And so those people that have jobs, they have a very... their budget goes to things that are first fixed expenses like rent, fuel in their cars, utilities, all the things they have to pay. What they have left is the money they have for food. And they see that that is the most flexible piece of their budget. So now they're going into the grocery store with little money left after all those other expenses. And then they're finding that the food that they would normally buy is more expensive. So they're not able to stretch their dollar the way they were. But you're right, they're going to go in and they're going to buy food that's calorie dense.
Or the 99-cent value menu at Taco Bell.
Exactly.
No offense, to Taco Bell, but it's not healthy food.
But they want to get their families fed. And if that means that they have to buy the cheapest food they can find, sometimes you're right, that isn't the most nutritional.
I have a very nice passage in your website about the problem of hunger in New Mexico and in the United States and the multiple steps that need to be done from emergency food to a much more kind of fundamental rethinking of our society. Okay, emergency food and food banks, those are things that it, thank goodness, exist and that you are working very hard on. But what about the bigger picture? How could it be changed in such a way that people have enough money to buy food, for example?
Well, there are lots of things that need to be done. First of all, food banks and food pantries were set up to supplement what people had. And we're finding that over the last 10 to 20 years, food banks and food pantries have become one of the top sources of food for working families. And we do want to get away from that. We want to go back to being a supplemental kind of a food program. And so we have a lot of things to look at. If we have affordable housing, if we have wages that allow people to feed their families, if we have full-time jobs, if we have good benefits for our employees. Healthcare is another one. We see a lot of people enter poverty simply because they've had a huge illness that has wiped out their savings. They've lost their job over it, and all of a sudden they're living in poverty, and these are people that used to donate.
Right.
And now they're turning around and they're finding that they have to get help. So we have to have good, affordable health care in our country. Those are some of the things, good wages, affordable health care, affordable housing, all of those things have to be done before people are going to really be able to lift themselves out of poverty.
It's, I think, very important to mention that although you do certainly have homeless people attending these soup kitchens and stuff that the food pantry donates to, I think the majority of the people, perhaps the vast majority of the people, are not homeless who take advantage of your work.
That's right. When you really do a breakdown of the people who are being helped, what we're seeing is that, first of all, about 25 to 30% of the people helped are children. Only about 10 to 11% of the people report being homeless. So we have another 25% of the people helped are seniors. And these are seniors who, you know, they've lived by all the rules. They've worked hard their entire lives. They're now retired. And they simply can't make ends meet with the money that they have coming in from Social Security. We're also finding, of course, that a lot of grandparents are now taking in their grandkids because they have to, of course, and they never planned on that. And so they're coming in and they're saying, we need help. We've applied for food stamps, but we're not getting enough. We need help here. And so we're seeing a lot more older people seeking help. We're finding, too, that they're telling us things like, you know, I only have this much money, and do I buy the prescriptions that I need, or do I pay for food? And what we want to do is make sure that the food pantries in town, the food pantries in New Mexico, are stocked well so that they can take that, remove the situation that would force an older person to make that kind of a decision. We don't want that to happen. We want to make sure that they can take the money they have to buy the prescriptions they need, the medicine that they need, so they can turn to a food pantry to get help.
We're talking to Sherry Hooper, Executive Director of the Food Depot, which, by the way, is on the web at thefooddepot.org. You've been doing this for quite a while.
Well, the Food Depot has been around since 1993.
Yeah.
And we actually have really grown over the last 10 years. We were fortunate to move into a building on Siler about 10 and a half years ago. And that really has allowed us to be a more traditional food bank and to serve those food pantries and kitchens and shelters that need our help. And we have more than tripled our output, our distribution of food since we moved into that building 10 years ago.
Which on the one hand is good, and on the other hand is kind of depressing.
Both, yes, exactly. You know, we talk a lot at the Food Depot about, wouldn't it be great to put ourselves out of a job?
Yeah.
Because there was no need for our services any longer. We don't foresee that happening, unfortunately.
There's a lot of food that goes to waste also. Is there anything that can be done about that?
Well, that's why food banks were started. Initially, there was a man in Phoenix that witnessed someone dumpster diving. And it was a woman with some children. And he thought there has to be a better way to make sure that that food doesn't go to waste and it gets to people who need it. That's actually why food banks were started. So a lot of the food that we have in our food bank is food that we've picked up or rescued from donors that would throw it into a dumpster, because it's not sort of the quality they would expect to put on their shelves. But it's still really good food.
Yeah, as I like to say, not museum quality.
Well, exactly. It's an apple with a bruise on it.
Right.
You know, and those kinds of things. Really good food. And that's what, especially here in Santa Fe, that's what we're picking up, is food that the grocery stores have taken off their shelves because it's just not of the perfect quality they want.
So you have an event coming up this weekend, the Super Bowl, S-O-U-P-E-R, Super Bowl, and it's, the 18th annual Super Bowl?
It is the 18th year for it, and it is an event that continues to grow, and we have people come back every year. They love it.
What happens?
Well, Super Bowl is set up. It'll be this Saturday from 11 to 1:30 at the Community Convention Center. And we have the entire ballroom. We have about 30 restaurants participating, and the restaurants have chosen a golden ticket. And this golden ticket tells them what category they'll compete in. And those restaurants will compete for the best soup in one of four categories: cream, savory, vegetarian, or seafood. And then all of them compete for the best overall soup. And the last 2 years, Jumbo Cafe has taken that award home.
Really?
Yes.
They're so good.
They are good. All these restaurants are incredible. So,
what kind of soup did they make?
Oh my gosh, it was a black bean soup, I believe, with sweet potatoes and coconut cream in it last year.
Uh-huh.
And then a year before, it was a peanut chicken soup. So, yes, and Ahmed, the wonderful chef at Jumbo Cafe, he reported to me that he can't keep those soups now. When he makes them, they're gone so fast. So it's something that people go into the restaurants and ask for after the event.
Very interesting. So you've got a lot of restaurants participating, and then a lot of just people, the public, showing up.
The public pays to get in, and when they do, they're given a ballot. It has a vote for each of those categories, and then the vote for the best overall soup. They go around, and you're talking 30 restaurants, a 4-ounce cup at each restaurant. If you try every single restaurant, that's like 8 or 10 cups of soup. I mean, it's a huge amount of soup.
Right.
And they go around tasting, and people take it very seriously. They go back and they taste, they take notes, and then they go and you, there's a ballot box at each of the restaurant's tables. You drop your vote for that, you know, in that category for that restaurant. We have the Boy Scouts helping us out this year again. They're runners, and so they pick up the votes, the ballot boxes, and we vote, we count the votes, and there's a big scoreboard up on the side. It's projected up onto the wall, so everyone can see how the restaurants are doing in their category. And then it's always a surprise at the end who won the best overall soup.
The best overall soup. I can't wait. I'm so looking forward to this event. Even though the issue underneath is very grave. I mean, here we are, we're in the middle of a 30-day or just starting a 30-day legislative session. When you look at the politics of New Mexico, you look at the politics of the United States, what can be done? What do you think can be done on a political level to address hunger?
Well, I think some of the things that I talked about earlier, I think affordable health care. You know, I don't know the ins and outs of President Obama's health care legislation, but I do know that it's helping more people, and that's what's needed. We have in the state legislature, they're looking at funding to the New Mexico Housing Trust. That would help get low-income people into homes. That's something that they should be looking at. And I know that there's a big push to ask the legislature to put $5 million into the budget for that. I would love to see that happen.
Yeah.
Those are the kinds of things that have to happen before people will ever be able to lift themselves out of poverty.
Do you see a movement toward people starting to grow their own food?
Absolutely. That's huge. And it's exciting to see, too. It gets us back to, what's amazing to me is children don't even, you know, you show them a green bean and they don't know where it came from.
I know.
A can.
I know. We talked about the cooking in schools program, and people look at a turnip, they have no idea what it is.
That's right. I've actually gone through the grocery store line, and someone had asked me what it was before they knew what the price was. So we've gotten so far away from that.
And the cashier say, What is this?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I have great memories of being on my grandparents' farm when I was a child and helping to pull things out of the garden and snipping green beans and, you know, canning and all of those things that would allow us to feed ourselves through the winter months kinds of thing. I'd love to see this happening again. And I think that is one of the positives that's really come out of the last 3 or 4 years and the economy being so poor, is that it has really made us look at ways that we can feed ourselves and be more self-sufficient.
And learning to grow your own food is no joke, especially if you've never had any experience with that.
Not at all, but there are so many places in town that they can learn how to do it. And we'd love to be a part of that. We don't have land to grow on right now, but we work a lot with the community farm, for example.
Where is the community farm?
It's San Isidro, over off of Agua Fria. And there are people who are really trying to grow that farm. And this last year, we provided compost. When we have produce that comes in from the grocery stores, we go through it, and that is really, really bad. We provide to the community farm for composting, and then they will donate a lot of what's grown at the community farm back to us.
So there is some really great fresh produce coming in that's going to, when we're talking about nutrition, going to people who need
it. Oh, absolutely. We're at the farmer's market during the summer. We are there at the end of farmer's market. Those farmers that didn't sell everything, they like to donate that to us. We bring it back, and that goes out to people in need as well.
So Sherry Hooper is executive director of the Food Depot, which once again is on the web at thefooddepot.org. Now, for those of you who would like to go to the Super Bowl number XVIII18, which is happening this weekend, this Saturday at the Community Convention Center from 11 to 1:30. So people can just show up, buy their tickets there, or they can get more information by calling?
Sure. Our website, they can buy tickets online as well. They can call us at 471-1633, and we can answer any questions they might have.
And some of the restaurants, I'm just going to randomly choose some restaurants from this list here because it's a little too long to read, but the Anasazi, Cafe Pasquale, Dinner for Two, Jumbo Cafe, La Plazuela at La Fonda, The Pantry, Pueblo, I don't know where that is, Pueblo Deli.
They're at Buffalo Thunder.
Oh, right, of course, okay. Santa Fe Steamer, The Whole Hog Cafe, Whole Foods, lots of places competing to see who's got the best soup.
That's right, a wide range of restaurants, and they're all great.
Well, Sherry Hooper, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Joe Illick. He is the artistic director of the Santa Fe Concert Association and Jean-Michel Charbonnet, who is a world-renowned soprano. This Saturday at 4 o'clock at the United Church of Santa Fe, the two of them will be doing a program. Joe will be talking about Richard Wagner's life. They'll be doing selections from Tristan and Isolde, including the Liebestod. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you both on the show. Now, let's talk about Tristan and Isolde. This is a revolutionary opera. It's a very important opera in the history of opera. Why is that?
It tells a story in a way that suspends time. Wagner was quite a lover. He had a lot of women in his life. He never hesitated to have children with other people's wives. But he nevertheless wrote to a friend that he was unhappy and had never found true love. So to really create true love, he had to write an opera.
I was reading in somewhere that he was writing Tristan and Isolde, and he showed part of it to three women. His wife, his lover, and his future lover were all in the audience. What a guy.
Yeah. What a guy, yeah. So we might as well say right up front, Wagner was kind of a monster. However, he was one of the greatest geniuses that has ever lived. And although his personal behavior went beyond having affairs to actually being in such debt that he was considered a criminal and was chased from several countries, he created a dozen operas that are still regarded as great masterpieces.
Now, Tristan and Isolde, do you want to tell us? I mean, he wrote both the libretto and the music?
He did. He did that every time.
And tell us the origins of this story. He got it out of the history of German literature?
Well, Tristan and Isolde actually comes before Germany, but the original story, which was 12th century, made its way to Germany, and there are lots of different versions of the legend. But Wagner tailored it to his own needs. Basically, there is a king of Cornwall, who has a nephew, and the nephew's name is Tristan. Tristan has a battle with an enemy of his uncle, and that enemy is named Morolt. Morolt, just bear with me, right? Morolt is engaged to an Irish princess named Isolde. Tristan kills Morolt, and Isolde, for some reason, when she has the opportunity to kill Tristan, instead heals him.
Well, even to add to that, Tristan not only knows of Isolde, he gets in a boat, injured, and ends up at Isolde to be healed, knowing that she is a great healer.
Knowing so also that he her killed her fiancé.
He killed her fiancé, yes. Now, you play the role of Isolde all over the world. Why do you think Isolde forgives Tristan instead of just killing him when she has the chance?
Right away. Well, remember, he presents himself as Tantris.
So but she figures it out.
She figures it out when she takes, as she says, she has the sword of her dead, or
fiancé.
He has Tristan's sword of her dead fiancé, which killed her dead fiancé, and she takes from his head a splinter. And it's a splinter that matches the sword that the man who's come to her to be healed, Tantris, has missing from his sword.
Right.
So she therefore knows that it's
Tristan.
She
knows he's the one that killed her beloved.
There are lots of arguments about whether Tristan and Isolde are in love with each other. Is it the potion that causes the love? I have to believe, generally, when I'm playing the character, although I have directors that have convinced me to try different ways, that Isolde falls in love with Tristan right away, with Tantris.
Before, and this is, by the way, before the opera even starts.
Yeah, this is all before we even begin the opera.
Ah, so we don't see any of this.
We're just giving you some backstory here.
No, this backstory is Isolde shares with you during her narrative in the first act.
Ah, so you sing this story.
Yeah, I sing this story.
So where does it actually start?
Well.
Yes, go ahead, Joe.
Okay. King Mark needs a wife. Like many dynasties, you need to marry somebody from the enemy side in order to guarantee political safety. So he has chosen his Irish bride, and he has chosen his nephew Tristan to bring his Irish bride to him on a ship. So the opera
Not
opens on the ship
and
from
I
Ireland
think Tristan
to Cornwall.
Goes back after he's healed and says to King Mark, I found the bride for you, Isolde. The Irish princess.
So he fixes her up with
his
uncle.
He's a tenor. He's kind of
and
dumb.
Then steals her away from
Basically.
The same guy he fixed
well,
her up with.
Well, now he doesn't steal her away.
Yes, it's not quite that simple. That would be too easy.
I haven't seen it, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay. So Isolde is very versed in the magical arts, as is her mother. Isolde does not want to marry King Mark. She doesn't want to be on the ship. She doesn't want to be leaving Ireland. She doesn't want any part of any of this. So her mother has packed up in her suitcase a love potion so that if things aren't very good with King Mark, Isolde can take the love potion and fall in love with him and it'll be better. But if things really are bad, there's also a death potion in there. It's not clear whether you put that in for yourself or whether you got your mother to do it.
No, it's not clear.
So somehow there's a love potion and a death potion.
So the love potion...
No, she does say... Brangaena does say she's put in a death potion. She does say that
the mother
did give it to her.
Has provided
yes.
both.
Yes.
So
right.
basically...
Good mother.
If I don't like the guy that much, I'll take the love potion. If that doesn't work and it gets really bad, I'll take the death
exactly. potion, right? Life with a sorceress as a mother is just different.
Yeah.
Different.
So here we are on the ship. And at the beginning of the opera, after an overture, which is extraordinary, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, we hear a sailor singing and sort of making fun of Isolde because all the mariners on the boat have had enough of her. She's not an easy traveler. And so Isolde hasn't endeared herself to anyone, and she says to her confidant and her maid, Brangaena, go get Tristan and tell him to come and talk to me. Tristan politely refuses. He says, I've got to sail a ship. I've got to get her safely to King Mark. Finally, Isolde makes it impossible for him to refuse. So he comes. And she says, you owe me this courtesy. We should drink a drink together. And she says to Brangaena, go get the death potion. So Isolde slugs it down, and then Tristan grabs it, and he does too.
He goes first.
That's right, he goes first.
Because he declares his honor before drinking it, knowing that he's about to be killed.
And then the end.
No.
Well, no. Because
that's only the first act.
Brangaena, the serving maid, has her own ideas, so instead of giving them the death potion, she gives them the love potion.
Ah.
Oh, it's such a good story.
And so then they fall madly in love with each other.
They do. Needless to say, this is inconvenient because she's about to be given to this powerful king, Tristan's uncle, whom he adores and whom he respects very much. But he's now in love with his bride.
And she with him. So then what happens?
Well there's an intermission and everybody goes out and drinks for half an hour.
You're right.
And drinks their love potions from the bar.
That's
the
right. Isolde can't wait to see Tristan. So she has a signal arranged outside of King Mark's castle. King Mark and his men go out on a hunt, and there's a big torch in front of the castle gate. And she's told Tristan, when that torch goes out, you come, and I will be waiting for you. You want to pick up the thread?
Yeah, I'm not as good at summarizing as you, but I'll do my best. So she has Brangaena extinguish the torch, the fakkel, and Tristan arrives, and they have a very important philosophical love duet, which is also incredibly sensual, about the day and night, which is Schopenhauer, basically.
Right.
And unfortunately, the man who he considered his best friend and the man that Isolde trusted, Melot, has told the king about this situation.
Uh-oh.
So he's betrayed Tristan.
Yes.
Right.
As they are about to consummate their relationship, maybe again, who knows? Or in one production, which I love, as they're about to take a suicide potion together, King Mark comes in.
I guess she didn't
and
throw
catches
it away.
Them.
Yeah, right. They still have that left over. They drank the love potion.
So he catches them. So that they are interrupted, and the tragedy begins, really, in the sense that King Mark, who is a very loving and wise man, has been betrayed by the person he trusted most in the world, Tristan.
Right.
And one of the guy that's betrayed Tristan, Melot, tries to protect King Mark, or protect his honor, and wounds Tristan mortally. End of Act Two.
So there's a whole other act.
There's a whole other act.
Yes.
Because once...
And this is opera, so we can give it all away.
Yes, I think so.
I'm guessing everyone dies.
How did you know that?
Surprise.
Just a really good guess.
No, actually, in this opera, they go to the Caribbean and everything is forgiven.
Exactly.
No, just
right,
kidding.
And they dance some salsa.
That's right.
No,
so what does happen?
What does happen?
Is that Tristan goes to Brittany and he is recovering with his dear friend Courvenal. And he's just hoping that before he dies, Isolde will come. But everything in Wagner is long, and he waits a long time.
As does the audience.
As does the audience, to see if this is going to happen.
Right.
And in the end, sure enough, it does happen. Not only does Isolde show up, but King Mark shows up again. And this time, he knows everything about the love potion.
Now, so he realizes it wasn't really anybody's fault.
Not only that, but he was prepared to forgive them and unite them and say it's all fine, but he's too late.
As is she.
As is she.
Ah, so Tristan dies.
He does.
With Isolde's entrance, of course.
Well, that's... Now, do love potions like that, do they wear off?
The last time I had... I can't remember.
That'd be interesting.
This
I mean,
one doesn't.
5 years later.
I haven't done that part of the character study. I guess I'm
well,
failing.
Well, actually, I read about this. There are several versions of the Tristan and Isolde story. And in some versions, the love potion wears off after 3 years.
Really?
Really. That I'm not making up. But in Wagner's mind, love is eternal. And this love potion never wears off.
And I must tell you that... In going into Tristan and Isolde productions, generally the first discussion that we have as a team is whether there's even a potion at all. Because many people, and myself included, would hold from what the music tells us that from the beginning, Tristan's in love with Isolde and Isolde's in love with Tristan. And that the love potion releases those inhibitions. Now, some Tristans actually believe that he didn't like her at all beforehand. But from my perspective...
Well, I mean,
not
there
so.
Is the whole killing the fiancé angle.
You know, this was the Middle Ages. People killed each other for all kinds of seemingly commonplace reasons. And
unlike now.
Unlike now.
You weren't watching the news last night, obviously.
And so if Tristan kills somebody as a matter of honor, that doesn't mean that he dislikes the woman that was going to marry him. He just had to do it.
Right. So you, Jean-Michel Charbonnet, were talking to Joe Illick of the Santa Fe Concert Station, and Jean-Michel Charbonnet, have played Isolde in all sorts of productions, predominantly in Europe, I think.
Yes, always. This, I'm about to do it for the first time in the United States.
I know, in Dallas.
In Dallas, very close to Santa Fe.
You're doing four performances starting on the 16th of February and going through the 25th of February at the Dallas Opera. Ladies and gentlemen who might want to take a little Southwest flight, just a little couple hours east. But anyway, what is it like for you to interpret this role over and over the course of a career?
Well, it's a huge honor and a gift for me. This is my favorite opera. I have one other I would put right up there with it.
What's that?
Bluebeard's Castle of Bartok. But I have many operas I adore, but this is my favorite.
Okay.
In part because I so adore the character of Isolde. She's an amazing woman on so many levels.
What do you like about her?
Well, I like that she's fiery and committed, and she's a princess. I kind of enjoy that aspect. Good clothes. No. What I enjoy about playing her is that I have such a path, such an arc of character in the process of the opera. She begins angry, hurt, always powerful, always verbal. We won't say she ever shuts her mouth. And then she becomes almost a teenager in love in the process of the love potion and her co-joining with Tristan. So that is just so interesting to already be those two sides of the character. And the love is, I think, very sensual and sexual, but also deeply spiritual. So you see a person go through a real arc of a life. And, of course, at the end, she's also devastated.
How old is she supposed to be? It's not a Romeo and Juliet where she actually is 15 years old or something.
Again, that's a discussion that all directors want to have. Most directors that I've worked with are happy to put her in around 30. But you could play her as young as 17 or 18.
Yeah, and 30 in medieval years is like 45.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's just their way to not complicate how we look. Although I will say that in Wagner, most people aren't singing this role at 30 years old. This is a role that happens later in one's life because this is dramatic soprano repertoire. Obviously, it takes a huge amount of stamina to sing for 5 hours and to sing a lot in 5 hours.
Just want to make sure everybody heard that. This opera is 5 hours long, basically sung by two people over a 100-piece orchestra the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's quite a feat.
And they
never
do
it. Which is probably also something I like about it because I like challenges.
They never do it in Santa Fe because the sun goes down so late and you'd be there till 2 in the morning.
That, and I think that the orchestra's so huge. Santa Fe, the orchestra they use here is.
But it could be done in Santa Fe.
With a reduced orchestra?
Well.
And oxygen tanks.
I think that they've had orchestras just as big when they did Elektra, and it would be beloved by thousands of people. So
it would be fabulous to do.
Just saying.
It would be incredible to do it in this setting.
It would, but, I mean, isn't the air here kind of thin?
No.
For singing that much?
Stop.
Really?
Yes,
no, that's
fun.
What I've heard. That's the people
singers,
say.
Definitely the altitude is something that one has to adjust to, and in the process of the summer, all the singers at Santa Fe Opera adjust. This kind of an opera, the same people that sing the Magic Flute are not going to sing Tristan. So you're going to have a different kind of singer that have a different kind of training, so the stamina is not the issue.
Do you remember?
I agree, and also an opera that begins at 7 o'clock and ends at, you know, just a little after midnight, it would be okay to have the first act of Tristan in the light.
Yes, because Tristan is about light and dark, day and night.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Santa Fe Opera, if you are listening now.
Charles, please forgive us. We didn't discuss this beforehand.
So, do you remember the first time you sang Isolde?
How could you not remember that?
I don't remember the first time I sang Isolde. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've never sung Isolde.
Maybe you'll sing it tomorrow. The first time I sang it was in a production in Naples, Italy. That was quite... Luis Pascual was the director, a Spanish director. And the conductor was Gary Bertini, who was a wonderful old Israeli director at the time. It was a conductor, sorry.
And what was it like for you to... I mean, this is a... kind of lifetime achievement in a way to sing that role and then to go through your very first performance. I can't even imagine. Did you have stage fright?
Well, I've been singing for a long time, so I do have nerves, but I don't have stage fright. So I won't say that. I did have respect and awareness of the huge task I was undertaking, as well as awareness of its place in history and what it means to be someone who gets to sing this kind of music. So there was the responsibility of being in that line. But yes, the whole experience is imprinted in my mind, but the thing that I can tell you is the Liebestod, the final aria that Isolde sings when she comes in over the body of Tristan, and when she transfigures, really, when she sees him becoming alive and something more, and she joins him, the experience of standing with that orchestra and singing that music is like nothing else in the world. It is otherworldly.
Now, you're going to be doing, the two of you, a program this weekend, and it's the Saturday.
Saturday at 4
o'clock. At 4 o'clock at the United Church of Santa Fe. So what will you be doing? You'll be both playing the piano, you'll be singing, Jean-Michel, talking about Wagner. Tell us about the program.
I would just like people who come to get a feeling for who Wagner was, how influential he was, how his music affected the whole development of Western music, and why he chose almost exclusively medieval stories, why he wrote all the words himself, what were the philosophical ideas that were important to him. And I think that people are naturally frightened off by operas that are so long, but there are so many things that you can find out about that give you something to hang on to, so that time really passes much more quickly than you think it's going to. Now, of course, we're going to be...
And it's an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So this will pass really quickly.
This will pass really quickly.
And I have to say, I'm just going to be singing two things, and I can't wait to
just
be charmed and educated and entertained by Joe, who's so brilliant, both at the piano and in his information sharing.
When I was 11, my mother and I went to the San Francisco Opera, and I went to my first opera. There were $3 student rush tickets, and we were in the back row of a 3,500-seat opera house. We didn't really know what we were seeing. We just thought it would be cool. And it was Tristan and Isolde with a woman named Birgit Nilsson, who was singing the lead
my goodness.
Role. And a tenor named Wolfgang Windgassen. And Wolfgang wasn't as powerful at that point in his career, I guess, as she was. But this was 1970. And my mother, by the end, was sleeping peacefully next to me. It was past midnight. And I was just sitting on the edge of my chair thinking, Birgit Nilsson is singing to only me.
That's amazing that you saw
that. At the age of 11.
It was incredible. So,
did that change your life? Did that set your career?
Yeah. It meant that we went to San Francisco Opera a lot. And I was in a boys' chorus. And our boys' chorus provided boys for all the operas that needed boys, like Faust and Otello and Carmen, and I got to sing in some of these. So it was wonderful. And yes, it really changed things for me. So I'm glad to be back with Tristan and Isolde.
And we're sharing it with lots of people.
Yeah.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. We're going to go out with some of the music from the Liebestod, and this is actually sung by you, Jean-Michel, so we're going to hear a little clip of that in a moment, but I want to ask you, I mean, you have here a combination of deep philosophical ideas on the part of Richard Wagner. You also have a major league womanizer who is creating his ideal love. How do those things work together?
I think they work together perfectly. Wagner fell in love with ideas just as passionately as he fell in love with women. And it seems sensible that he would create the union of the two, but had to go to art to do it, because the kinds of things that he imagined didn't exist in real life. The operas that he imagined didn't exist. Wagner not only created a whole new kind of opera, he had to create a new kind of opera house, invent instruments. I mean, he wasn't content with anything as it existed. He had an incredibly creative mind and had the will and the manipulative abilities to get people to help him create everything that he wanted to bring into existence.
The event is this Saturday at 4 o'clock. It's the Santa Fe Concert Association, whom you can find on the web at santafeconcerts.org. Joe Illick is the artistic director. Jean-Michel Charbonnet is a world-renowned soprano whom we have the great privilege of hearing because usually she is singing in Europe, although, as we said before, you'll be singing in Dallas in February at the Dallas Opera. And this event is co-presented with the Wagner Society of Santa Fe. And if you want to hear more about what they are up to, you can simply write to Wagner Society of Santa Fe at gmail.com. Joe Illick and Jean-Michel Charbonnet, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It was absolutely an adorable conversation. Thanks.
And now let's hear some of the Liebestod. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.